Welcome to On Strategy Showcase. I'm Fergus O'Carroll in Chicago. You can connect with me on LinkedIn, or you can see all of the work associated with this episode, the creative work, and connect with our guests on our website, onstrategyshowcase.com. And you can also get our phenomenal 2024 sponsor kit right on that homepage. So it's amazingly convenient. A couple of things I wanted to touch on. We are going to be producing and launching a new series in the end of this month. Towards the end of this month, it'll start. It's a brand management series that is going to involve brand leaders on brands and companies at various stages of growth. The first episode is going to be focused on startups, the second on scale-ups, and the third on grown-ups, so more mature brands. We're trying to understand at each of these phases of growth, the marketing strategies, the marketing priorities, the marketing mixes, the challenges that brands are facing, how they're addressing them, and the role of brand in that journey. It's going to be clients only. So there'll be three guests per episode. The actual series, I wanted to thank Tracksuit for sponsoring the series. And if you're not familiar with Tracksuit, they're a wonderful group that are offering an affordable way for marketers to track brand health and demonstrate return on marketing spend. You can learn more at gotracksuit.com. So look for that series to come up soon. Also, and I know we've only got a couple of days before this deadline will expire, but I wanted to mention it here in this episode. If you're listening to this episode before February 7th, 2024, you can take advantage of this opportunity from the Master of Advertising Effectiveness Program. We are offering, and they are offering, two free seats for the February 14th session. If you're if you want to learn more about this, you can go to mae.academy. It's a six-week online program on evidence-based principles of marketing effectiveness. It's taught by James Herman, who's one of the great thought leaders on this topic, along with Wark. Wark is involved in this also. I would strongly encourage you to check out the program. If you are interested in your chance at getting one of these two free seats, you can send an email to us at hello@onstrategyshowcase.com. hello@onstrategyshowcase.com. Now, you don't need to write us an email. You just need to put MAE seat in the description of the email and just send it to us. And that'll enter you into a drawing. And we're going to draw the winners at the end of the day on Wednesday, the 7th of February, Chicago time. Good luck to everybody on that. I also wanted to talk a little bit about today's episode. We're talking with Johnny Ewell. Johnny is a strategy partner at Media Monks in London. We're going to be talking about Mini, and more particularly, and more specifically, should I say, the Mini Clubman. Now, the Clubman vehicle was about 2 years away from being completely refreshed. So the strategy here was not about repositioning the Clubman or doing an overall refresh of marketing. It was looking to discover ways to achieve sort of incremental sales gains. And what's interesting about this is the fact that they studied various different segments and lifestyles, and they were able to uncover a couple of different opportunities, one being the one that we're going to be talking about today. Now, if you're in the U.S. and you're familiar with Subaru in the U.S., Subaru has had this love platform for many years, and one of their distinctive assets in their marketing has been the use of dogs. And they've done some really great work, a very memorable work here in the U.S. But that is not how Subaru is marketed in the U.K. And our conversation today is around a U.K. case. In the U.K., they have just sort of refreshed the Mini brand on the brand platform of Big Love. And the program we're going to be talking about today, ironically, involves going after dog owners. Now, dog owners is not a small niche market. In the U.S., for example, 44% of U.S. households own dogs, That's according to Forbes Advisor survey data in 2024. I believe that number is around 35% in the UK. So it's a sizable market. And there are product features on this particular vehicle, the Clubman, that are perfect for dog owners. And we'll hear about that as we go through this conversation. So I'm excited to have the opportunity to talk with Johnny Yules, strategy partner at Media Monks in London. I hope you guys enjoy it. You can see, as I say, the work on our website. Enjoy. So Mini is a brand that we know pretty well here in the U.S. I grew up in Ireland, so I'm very familiar with Mini from the early days. We actually owned a Mini. My mother owned a Mini. And I actually learned to drive in a Mini. So I know the heritage of this a little bit. So when Johnny and I talk today, we'll go back and forth between the experience of Mini in the U.S., which is really originally framed around that early work from Crispin back around roughly 2000-ish, I think, or a little bit after that. They did some really interesting work that was introducing the Mini into the U.S. So we'll go back and forth between the U.S. Lens on Mini and the U.K. lens on Mini, because this is a case study that is U.K.-based. So great to have Johnny with us. Johnny, thanks for being here.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Love to join this prestigious community of planners, and I've been working on the brand for about 3 and a bit years now. So it's lovely to have a bit of work that gets celebrated amongst the industry.
Yeah, I remember when it came here, it was really subversive in its tactics, and what Crispin did for it here, an example of, maybe we'll put this up on the website, but an example was they put a Mini on top of a Ford Excursion or Expedition, which is this oversized SUV, the big gas guzzlers back in the day. They still are, of course. But they put Mini on top of it, and they drove it around major cities and took photographs of it. And then so they were always sort of working off the playfulness and the fun aspect of Mini and the responsible aspect of Mini. It wasn't so much the icon, the sort of the iconic image of Mini, which is more present in the UK, but they did brilliant work, and they kind of presented it as this sort of, they would show it in oversized, like matchbox car boxes. They were huge, but the Mini was inside the matchbox car box. And so they began to do some really interesting things where people could walk by and see a full-size Mini inside a toy box of the vehicle. So it was wonderful stuff for a long time, and it went through many changes. We don't see as much about Mini here as we used to back then, but I'm excited to have this conversation today. So why don't we start off by telling us about sort of the state of the Mini business prior to the campaign that you were working on, because I believe this campaign launched maybe 2 years back, or am I wrong?
Yeah, that's right. So actually, it launched at pretty much the sort of height of COVID, really, back in 2021. It was interesting what you were just saying about how they launched into the US. And it's the same story in markets like China as well, where the Mini's been introduced to markets over the last 20, 30 years for its iconic smallness, I guess. And wanting to celebrate that and put it into matchbox size boxes and almost, talk about its toy likeness as something that should be heroed. And actually what this brief was all about is, we've been known as a small car for, 60 odd years. And actually one of the things that's always been on the radar for us, in that certainly since I've been here, and while we've had cars like the Mini Countryman, the Mini Clubman, which is what this brief was all about, is actually people have that synonymous association with smallness, but actually we do have some big cars, and really the future of the brand, many would argue, is to have that balance, give people access to Mini, whether that's the big version or the small version. So our brief was really sort of centered on that. It's, how do you get, people to realize that Minis can not just be small and fun and playful and go-karty, but also practical and useful in, day-to-day life.
Because Mini, for those who are not familiar with the UK racing scene, Mini, even though it's arguably one of the smallest cars that I'm aware of anyway, it is big in racing. I mean, there are dedicated races that are Mini Coopers that for decades that had been going on. So they weren't only sort of small, but they could be very high performance. They were fun. They were exhilarating. They were, as you say, go-kart-like. There was this sense of fun, playful performance that was a part of that, the history of Mini, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It went from just being a bit of a pop icon and a sort of solution to what at the time was an oil crisis because of its smallness and its efficiency. But actually, it became a bit of a became known as a rally car and something that was fun to drive as well. When you do drive a Mini, it does feel different, and it does feel there's an exhilaration to this. You particularly got that with the Mini Electric, which we were launching at the same time in 2020. So if you that was the sort of go-kart feeling supercharged because you put your foot down and it's got all of the sort of electric instant torque as well.
So then where was the business in 2019? So can you kind of give us a sense of where the business was overall in the UK?
Yeah, in terms of, I just mentioned as well the sort of state of people not recognizing necessarily or being as aware of our bigger cars. The unaided model awareness for the Cooper itself is sky high, but for the Countryman and the Clubman, they always lose out. The unaided model awareness is about a third of that of the Cooper. And then we're also going through a bit of a sort of brand reinvigoration as well. So there was a new brand idea called Big Love, which is a sort of big positive statement out into the world. And with that, we were always like looking for ways, I guess, to sort of communicate our community mindedness and the scene around these cars. It's almost cult-like and fanatical.
Yeah.
So something like Big Love as a platform is a really lovely expression of that, and something that we always, we always wanted to imbue any communications with.
In terms of sales, where had sales been flat for a while, and there was hope within these new nameplates that were coming out, or was there trouble in paradise, or was everything strong? You just needed to look for incremental growth. I mean, how would you describe the overall sort of landscape?
The landscape at the time was pretty good. We were launching a new electric car. We just launched the Countryman, and given that, a decent campaign communicating size credentials. But the number one reason people don't buy a Mini is because of the practicality and size. So that was, as always, a niggling thing that we're trying to find ways to communicate. And the Clubman in particular had, to be honest, been struggling for a couple of years. The positioning of it wasn't quite right. The way it was talked about maybe wasn't finding relevance with its audience. What we wanted to do is have a look at the positioning of that car and look at a new way of communicating it. Now, because the electric was dominating our headlines and also therefore dominating our spend, we knew that this needed to be done on a relatively modest sort of secondary budget. And the original ask from the client was, okay, well, what can we do to sort of change some of the messaging? But the main issue with it was this: the Clubman. The main issue was that people didn't really understand what to call it. So we did a community survey, which showed that 30% of people thought it was an estate, and 30% of people thought it was a hatch. And there was another 30% of people who actually didn't know what to call it at all.
So it's just for the American listeners. So it was like this: is it a family sedan or is it a hatchback? And the reason was because it had sort of a unique design feature, as I remember it. It had back doors that opened up. What are those style of doors?
Call them barn doors.
Barn doors.
Yeah. So it was called a sort of six door, which I can imagine in the States you'd just think about as a juggernaut, and actually this thing is more like the size of a Golf. So to claim it was an estate car, like I guess your sort of family sedan, like you say, like a bit of a Volvo would sort of own that space, would be a bit of a stretch, and calling it a hatch would be underselling its sort of utility, I guess, as well.
So again for the American audiences, just so they can track along with us. So you've got the Mini, and the base Mini was a two-door vehicle, right?
Yes, but there is two side doors.
Two side doors. And then what we're talking about here when we talk about the Clubman and the Countryman, they're good-looking vehicles, but it's not like you went from a standard Mini up to a full-size SUV. I mean, we're talking about maybe it's less than 50% larger. It's not huge, but it seems to come with a lot more interesting features that sort of moved it into different segments where you could now compete, where before you couldn't, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think the its sort of extended rear and its what we call barn doors just gave it something a little bit more practical for people. So, it was a little bit quirky in its design, but actually, because of the extra space, it allowed people who liked Mini and were maybe a slightly different life stage to think, actually, do you know what? Maybe I'll do stick with the brand.
The Mini here in the US, it seems like it has very few competitors in its segment. And it looks like the Fiat has this small nameplate. I can't remember what it is, that was selling pretty well. It's around the same size as a Mini. And then there was probably, although it was in a separate class, it seemed like you were almost competing against the likes of the Prius here in the U.S., was it the same over there? Are there different competitors that you can share with us on how those competitors were positioned versus how the Mini was positioned, just to sort of set the stage for the conversation?
Yeah. So the Mini hatch, so the one you refer to as the two-door, we call it the three-door or the five-door. Yeah, that they would compete with the Fiat 500, which you mentioned.
Yeah, that's it.
Well, you know, at a stretch, but the five-door one would be competing probably with the Golf or the Mercedes A-Class. We've also got the Audi A3 in there. Then when you stepped up to the Clubman, now the Clubman, again, would want to position itself as a more practical car, but it was still, you know, depending on who you spoke to or depending on what you read, it was still competing with that larger Golf. And then you've obviously got the Countryman. And the Countryman, which was the relatively small SUV, but it definitely offers a lot more space compared to the hatch, and that's competing with the BMW X1, the smaller kind of like Audi SUVs as well.
I mean, is it fair to say that somebody who's buying an Audi is also considering a Mini? It seems like that's a stretch for me because. Or a Mercedes-Benz, because I've always felt that a Mini driver, in terms of their characteristics, their personality, what they want to say about themselves, are very different than those who choose an Audi or a Mercedes or a BMW. Is that not the case in the UK? Because it kind of is here. We have very different motivations and what they want, the signal they want to send about themselves.
Yeah, I think that's totally true because... You know, we talk about having a more kind of, you know, a Mini spirit. Now we talk about, you know, having a sort of big love spirit. We talk about having, you know, an optimistic view of the world and everything kind of in Mini world is about that sort of, you know, sense of positivity and optimism. And that is almost a bit of an attitudinal lifestyle differentiator compared to those brands. So on paper, yeah, you might be, you know, in the first instance, you might be scoping out a Clubman or a Countryman based on its stats, but actually you'd be buying it for its spirit.
We'll be right back. This series is brought to you by Tracksuit, a beautiful, affordable, and always-on brand tracking tool that helps you answer the question, is what we're doing working? A not-so-secret fact is that companies pay $100,000 or more for brand tracking, which is out of the question for modern brands whose budgets are under pressure. Tracksuit has been built by marketers for marketers and makes brand tracking 10 times easier and 10 times more affordable. Their research experts do the heavy lifting by using best-in-class practices to craft the questions and get your survey live. Tracksuit surveys thousands of people each week from panels of millions around the world to give you full visibility of your brand health in 30 days, with insights updated for your brand daily. Tracksuit is fast becoming the common language for marketers and agencies to measure, understand, and communicate the value of brand building. Check them out at gotracksuit.com. That's gotracksuit.com. Now back to the show. Yeah, exactly. Because that does seem to be, it's almost like Harley Davidson versus a Suzuki or a Yamaha or a Honda motorcycle. It's like you deliberately choose a Harley because of what it stands for. And that's probably the same for most brands in the automotive segment. But you want to send very strong signals about what you're not when you drive a Mini in the US. I mean, you are saying, look at me for different reasons. And I'm wondering, in the UK, is it that same sort of thing where you want to be deliberately different?
Oh, this is interesting. I don't think it's quite as different, because I think it's just more established here as a brand. So I don't, there's so much heritage in the brand here in the UK that I don't think it feels maybe as distinctively different, but certainly, you know, the types of driver, you know, that we always like to communicate to do have that, you know, a radiance, I guess. That's something we always want to tap into. If, you know, if we're briefing influencers or looking for talent, you're always looking for what we call sort of big love personality. So there is a personality to it. But ultimately, you're buying this car for its fun and the feeling. You're not buying it to demonstrate your worth necessarily.
Last point on this, I think in the U.S., Subaru was a brand that tended to be associated historically with more progressive individuals, people who deliberately did not want to drive a Toyota or a Honda or a Ford or a General Motors vehicle. They were sort of signaling that they joined, that they belonged to a different community. And so are there sort of characteristics when you think about the buyer of a Mini? Is there a set of characteristics that seem to be common amongst them that make them unique?
I would say that when we've done things like surveys, statements around having a positive outlook, being optimistic, being interested in pop culture, these kind of things, they always stand out. And so definitely when we are, you know, thinking about how we target our work and how we create our work, we're looking to sort of reflect some of that back.
The goal was incremental sales. It wasn't a complete repositioning of the Clubman, is that fair to say?
So Clubman was going away, and we'd had hints about this when the brief came in. It's got a couple of years left. It's going to be replaced by a whole new model, you know, soon to be announced. And so, in its final years, you know, what could we do to give it a bit of an injection?
So you get this briefing. What do you do from a planning perspective, given that you have limited budget?
So when we first got the brief, obviously the first port of call was, again, what existing research is there? There was this Mini community panel piece of work that showed us, profiled the audience. And we know that, you know, versus the three-door, five-door hatch, the Clubman of the Country audience was all orientated around families, kids, people who were looking for something more practical. And so what we were trying to do, and we were doing further digging and forums online, was to look at the way that people were using it. And we got hooked on this idea of kind of life's missions, and this idea that, you know, that these are people who are sort of stepping out maybe into the sort of more serious parenting world, or, you know, they may be like redecorating the house and they're going to the, you know, B&Q, which is a trade store.
Yeah, like a Lowe's or a Home Depot here.
Yeah, exactly. So they're using it for these missions, these like life missions. We were really hooked on this idea, but you know, every time we went back with some different language around this, and we were kind of bouncing between strategy and creative, and really kind of cracking it together in small rooms over a few weeks. It felt like we were getting somewhere with it, but it still felt like there was something that needed to be done if we were really going to do this with scale and some kind of more meaningful intervention in life that maybe helps to sort of position it outside of the world, like I said, of banners and website, because you know that stuff was always going to get relatively modest traffic. And so really we wanted to do something that was kind of like out there in the world. And that's what like pushed us to dig a little deeper, to think, is there a subset that we might be able to focus on? Is there a little nugget of insight that gives us something that we can really double down on and put almost a disproportionate amount of attention to.
Love it. And so what kind of territory or territories did that line of thinking lead you to?
So this was, again, we went back to the same studies and we said, okay, then, you know, is there more here? Like, what have we got? And there was a really nice piece of research that showed how it's over-indexed with dogs, and actually there was a link here which was even bigger with the clubman than it was with the countryman, and that's the thing that we wanted to explore a bit further. And we found ourselves, you know, for a couple of weeks or deep in dog forums where people are commenting on the most appropriate dog-friendly car, and you know, obviously the default and actually the reigning car was the Land Rover Discovery, which was the Sunday Times dog friendly car of the year. There were also cars like, you know, there were Subarus in there. There were, sort of the bigger Kias and so on. But actually there was a sort of pocket of people who were talking about the Clubman in this really interesting way. And we thought, okay, do you know what? That's something that we should dive into, but you know, we needed to prove that there was a real causal link here. It wasn't just the, you know, the voice of the few that, you know, might send us down the wrong tracks.
And so this was in part because of these barn doors at the back. And the barn doors are like closet doors. You know, the handles are in the center and you pull them towards you and it opens up double doors. So you opening up the entire back part of the car from center to left and right rather than bottom to top. So it has this unique sort of barn door feel to it. So is that why it had that sort of increased practical fit for dog owners?
Yeah, exactly. So this right. was a is so if you imagine you can have one open at the same at once, so if you're going to let your dog out of the car, you can sort of slowly open it rather than opening it top bottom to top.
Nice.
which way your dog's going to come out. So actually it was a really nice way of sort of, you know, being in more control of your dog's exit of the car, which might sound funny, but actually to the people that had the car, they spoke really passionately about this, including our two most senior clients. So they once we started talking about this, they got involved and they were kind of advocating for this in a way that they'd never spoken about before in previous meetings. So suddenly there was a real sort of energy around, oh god, this is a really, really sort of, you know, like the perfect car for dogs. Both of these clients had big black labs, I think.
Yeah, it's kind of the same thing when you open your trunk from if it lifts from bottom to top. Who hasn't had a time when groceries start pouring out of the back of your trunk because you can't control it until the lid is halfway up? But I suppose with these barn doors, you can manage, as you say, the degree to which you open it up, and you always have control of what might come running out of it.
Yeah, exactly. And then if you combine that as well with the fact it's actually quite a low boot, and most cars that would sort of position themselves as practical are, you know, sort of bigger SUVs. And I didn't realize this at the time, but when you have those, if you have a small dog, for instance, and you have a big car, you need a dog ramp. So, because actually jumping down from that height is actually quite dangerous. So actually a low boot combined with these barn doors was absolutely perfect, but it wasn't something we talked about anywhere.
So what's interesting for the US listener, here in the US, Subaru's entire platform of love uses dogs. It's a big part of what they of what they use in their advertising, that whole part of family and connection to the animal, and they do many of the things that are I think a part of this case. So just so people in the US realize, that's not the way Subaru I believe is positioned in the UK. There isn't another brand out there that's doing this. So for the US listener, just realize that this is a distinct strategic approach in the UK, right?
Yeah, that's totally right. There's been a few brands who have, you know, released dog packs in the last few years and made a bit more of a play, but at that time there was nobody who was really kind of positioning themselves as the go-to for being dog friendly.
So that felt like, go ahead, sorry.
And that felt like a really interesting opportunity for us as a kind of community-minded brand, you know, with a sort of big love under our belts as well.
When I read the case, you mentioned this already, the idea that you looked at some of the quant work, and some of the quant work basically said that consumers would think that the three-door hatchback or the Mini in general would be very suitable for dog owners. So you saw that there. You hadn't quantified it yet, though. It was sort of saying that people perceived it that way. It wasn't necessarily saying in that existing quant that you had that dog owners were owning and buying Minis. It was just saying that it would be practical enough for a dog owner, was what your initial research said. So you had to go out and quantify that, right, to actually figure out whether this sort of perception was in fact a reality, right? Is that what you had to do?
Yeah, exactly. So we commissioned our first Project Dog report and a little study that went out to the CRM base. I think it was actually the fastest response that we'd ever had to any survey. So we knew there was something quite exciting there when you've got 2,000 respondents in the space of half a day. But yeah, that the results of that were really interesting, and yeah, some of the stats that came out of that were that 95% of people's dogs were happy in a clubman. So this is amongst clubman owners, we asked the question: is your dog happy in the car? 95% had said yes, and interesting with the clubman in particular, 7 out of 10 owners. Dog owners specifically had bought the Mini Clubman because they knew their dog would be comfortable in it. So yeah, what we sort of deduced from that was actually that dogs were influencing purchase.
So for the listener, there's two phases to the campaign. First, you needed to sort of associate the brand with dog ownership. So as I understand, then the second phase, there was a different aspect that you began to leverage. Can you tell us about that first phase and what that involved?
You know, initially we were thinking, hey, maybe this is a nice opportunity to promote dog-friendly travel with your car and associate that with the clubman, and that would become the halo. But actually, it felt like there was a more meaningful intervention that we could have here. We had a conversation with Dogs Trust, this UK charity, who help with dog rehoming, things like that. And they talked about the fact that there was a huge surge in people actually giving up their dogs, their COVID dogs. And actually, sort of dog ownership and the troubles around that became a bigger conversation in people's minds. And actually, we thought about this then as a bigger mission. What we wanted to do is actually use our kind of, you know, our full ecosystem and network of opportunities. And that was to become the first official dog-friendly retailer network. Nobody else had done that. That was something that Dogs Trust were really interested in. It could enable them to communicate everything they want to communicate about, dog sort of behavioral tips and, you know, and also look to our retailers and think about how we get them trained up with sort of dog insight and being able to find the most suitable cars and communicate sort of communicate dog behavior education to our customers.
You mentioned earlier you didn't have a very large budget, but you guys, from a comms perspective, you produced a spot that ran in movie theaters or cinemas, right? And with very specific sort of content targeting. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, we targeted ads around Paw Patrol. We had a dogs hub for people that were clicking through from our advertising. We had travel guides that were going out via Dogs Trust channels. We were going to dog fluencers. We actually also went to we had an activation, sort of crust style activation at Dogfest, which was for around sort of 10,000 dog owners in Alexandra Palace in North London.
I think one of the things you pointed out before was what happens in terms of this comparison now between the pedestal that Land Rover sat on or held for many years. That sort of becomes a sort of a big success signal for you guys. What happens to Land Rover's position as being the dog car of the year?
Very few opportunities seem to have such sudden impact in the conversation. When we were first investigating, you know, what to do with the Clubman campaign, and we were, you know, searching the trade press, the Top Gears of this world, everybody was talking about the Clubman in slightly different ways. But suddenly, you know, by kind of drawing on this energy around, you know, it being the ultimate dog friendly car, and us as a dog friendly car brand, you know, suddenly it meant that the industry also listened up, and it was we had a really tight connection with the PR team at Mini as well, which really helped. So they hosted a number of sort of dog events with the Clubman and got the industry to listen as well. And actually, what, you know, where that ended up in a matter of months was winning this accolade of Dog Friendly Car of the Year. And yeah, it depositioned the Land Rover Discovery, which is a car that, you know, on face value, on stats, you could never compete with. But in terms of spirit and also this kind of newfound language we had in being able to talk about the car's features, suddenly we were, you know, we'd elevated this car from into a whole new category.
What about at the end of all this, in terms of the results that you feel most proud of? Are there things that you can share with us?
Where previously people didn't know how to categorize it or talk about its features, suddenly you've got this language that's just rolling off the tongues of the industry. We certainly had some really good results from a brand perspective as well when we commissioned studies. So people seeing us as a brand that has practical cars, which is always something that's you know, been very challenging. So that as a stat increased by 16 percentage points. Commercially, it was actually a time that was quite tricky to prove the eventual sales impact, because
yeah, and this is a pretty key part of it, because we've got to remember that manufacturing of new vehicles over the pandemic and post-pandemic took a lot of time to recover because of access to components. So that really sort of slowed down. Even if you wanted to buy a vehicle, it was hard to even find a vehicle, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think, yeah, a lot of the sales numbers were quite distorted as a result. And then also there's, you know, there's a practical challenge that we have always previously had, which was about, actually sort of proving the impact of our advertising, when actually the sales are always closed by retailers. So yeah. So that's why really our sort of, you know, the spikes that we saw in traffic around the time of the campaign, the spikes in leads, as well as the brand impact and the industry response, you know, those as ingredients gave us a really compelling story to say, yeah, let's keep pushing on this, because this is clearly working.
It is Johnny Yules. He's strategy partner at Media Monks in London. Thanks, Johnny.
Thank you very much.
And we'll see everyone on the next episode.